Welcome, everyone, to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is IBM HTTP Server Logging Essentials for Advanced Debugging. Today's presenter is Robert L. Baretti, Jr. Rob has been with the IBM Corporation for over 15 years, providing technical support to IBM customers. He has over 10 years' experience supporting the IBM HTTP Server component and is currently an advisory software engineer and subject matter expert with Level 2 WebSphere Application Server support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Rob.
Thank you, David. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's presentation, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to attend. The key to advanced debugging in the IBM HTTP server is knowing how to expose the logging capabilities the web server provides. Knowing what, when, and how to capture specific data output in the logs is vitally important to this task. This knowledge or know-how is what I like to refer to as the logging essentials for advanced debugging. Let's proceed to slide number 2 to get started. For starters, the information provided today pertains to the IBM HTTP Server version 6.1 and higher. In addition, I will be focusing on the IBM HTTP Server logging in many cases as it relates to WebSphere Application Server environment. However, due to time constraints, this presentation does not cover plugin logging. There are previous WebSphere technical exchanges already that focus on the plugin and its logging capabilities. Please check out the WebSphere technical exchange website for more information. With that said, let's proceed to slide number 3 to discuss the agenda. Okay, so this presentation consists of 3 parts. The first being rather simple, but important to know. Yes, an overview of the logs. What logs does the IBM HTTP server write to? Where to find them, and what are the default settings. Secondly, together we will dig deeper and learn how to enable the IBM HTTP server to output the essential data we need for real debugging and data gathering. Yes, the logging essentials. Third and finally, I will share with you some examples on what to log for specific types of situations and problems. All right, so let's proceed to slide number 4 to get started with the overview. Okay, so first, the error log is the main server log the IBM HTTP server writes messages to during startup and during runtime. By default, the log will be created in the IHS root logs directory. It is defined using the error log directive, and the number or types of messages recorded is controlled by the log level directive. The type of messages can include error, warning, informational, critical, alerts, emergency, and debug messages. For debugging purposes, IBM support recommends the log level debug. Log level debug will record any of the message types I mentioned earlier. Please visit the link provided here if you want more information regarding the available log levels. Okay, let's proceed to slide number 5. Okay, so next we have the access log. This log is the IBM HTTP server request log and will log all HTTP requests such as GET, POST, HEAD requests, etc. By default, the log will be created in the IHS root logs directory and is defined using the custom log directive. Now, the detail of information that is logged in the access log is dependent on the log format. Now, notice here the default settings list several log formats to choose from. Each log format line ends with a unique text string, such as combined, common, etc. It is this text string that is then added to the custom log directive, indicated which log format should be used for the access log defined. Now notice the access log by default uses the common log format. So let's proceed to slide number 6, where I will explain this further. Okay, so format strings are very important when it comes to debugging, and especially when it comes to advanced debugging. I have been supporting the IBM HTTP server for a long time now and can't imagine debugging problems without them. I will discuss log formats throughout this presentation in much more detail, but for now, let's stick to the overview. Okay, so here you can see the default common log format provides a fair level of information such as the client IP address, the date, time the request was received by the server, the request line, which contains the request method and the URI, and the request status code, etc. Okay, so proceed to slide number 7, please. Okay, this is a slide you don't want to forget. The first link provides a chart which lists out all available format strings. I recommend you keep this handy. Also, here is a quick hint tip, a prelude to what is to come in the upcoming slides. If you need to debug a performance problem in the IBM HTTP server, it is essential that you log how long each request took to complete. From the moment the web server reads in the request to the time it completes writing the response. %t logs the amount of time it takes in seconds, while %d logs it in microseconds. I personally prefer %d since it is a more precise measurement and can be converted to seconds if needed. The second link on this slide also discusses these formats. In addition, it provides help on how to find requests which are taking the longest amount of time to be served, so a really good tech note. With that said, let's move on and proceed to slide number 8 to talk about another important log. Ah, yes, the rewrite log. By default, there is no rewrite logging enabled in the IBM HTTP server, but you can enable rewrite logging using the rewrite log directive and the rewrite log level directive to define the level of logging you want. Now, we often do see PMRs in support related to rewrite problems, and in most cases, we ask for rewrite logging, especially when there are numerous rules and conditions defined in the web server config file. The default value of 0 means no logging, while the maximum level of 9 means that all actions will be logged. Personally, I would say a log level of 9 is essential for debugging rewrite problems. Anything less, in my opinion, is inadequate. Okay, so let's proceed now to slide number 9. So here we have a rewrite example and log output. There are two rewrite conditions and one rule. Basically, these rules are saying that any request that comes into this web server on port 80 as non-SSL with a URI starting with MyApp should be redirected to the MyApp login.jsp page over SSL. So, for example, if a client issues a request for the MyApp homepage over non-SSL, they will be redirected to the login page URL, which is an HTTPS URL. Now, when looking at the log details, you can clearly see this is what happens. In addition, you can clearly see how rewrite processing essentially works. Notice that mod rewrite first tries to match the incoming URI to the defined rule. If it finds a match, it then proceeds to look at the conditions above the rule to see if the conditions are met. If both conditions are met, then mod rewrite knows it can execute the rule and rewrite the incoming URI to the new URL defined in the rule. So since the R flag is used, this means redirect, and therefore mod rewrite proceeds to perform a redirect action on the new URL, and then finally, the new rewritten URL is redirected with a 302 status code. Okay, next slide, please, slide number 10. Okay, so this concludes the overview part of today's presentation. The next section is where we get to the heart of logging essentials for advanced debugging in the IBM HTTP server. Now, there is a lot of material still left to cover, and I will be picking up the pace a bit. I ask that you remain focused on the presentation here, since some of the slides build off each other, and I don't want you to miss anything. Trust me, this is good information you will want to have in your debugging arsenal. Okay, let's get started by proceeding to slide number 11. Okay, let me say this plainly. Trying to debug problems within the IBM HTTP server utilizing default logging simply won't cut it. Some of the information can be helpful, but it simply is not sufficient. Therefore, I have come up with a list of the 4 logging essentials for advanced debugging. Number 1, the logging of inbound or outbound HTTP headers. Number 2, the logging of HTTP cookies. Number 3, using environment variables for logging purposes. And finally, number 4, utilizing the logging capabilities of the debug modules provided in IHS-DIAG. I have been supporting the IBM HTTP server for a while now, and I would conclude that these four logging essentials are not only recommended, but also required in many cases. Kind of like an umbrella in the rain. A really good thing to have, probably don't want to go without it. Okay, so let's talk about these in more detail, starting with the next slide, slide number 12. Okay, first, any inbound or incoming HTTP request header can be logged in the access log. And I mean that, any HTTP request header. This is done by using percent bracket, then listing the name of the header you want to log, then close bracket, and finally the letter I. I stands for inbound. Next, to log any outbound or outgoing HTTP response header, you use the same format, but instead of I, you would use the letter O. O stands for outbound. It is also useful in many cases to prefix your format string with a text string. This helps in identifying the headers more clearly when reviewing the access log. This will make more sense in the upcoming slides, I promise. So let's go ahead and proceed to the next slide, slide number 13. Okay, so here we have an example of an HTTP request headers and HTTP response headers. Notice the host header. If you want to log a host header, you would use percent bracket host bracket and the letter I. Now for the response, if you want to log, let's say, a cache control header, you would use percent bracket cache control bracket and the letter O for outbound. Now this may seem kind of trivial to some, but be aware, the web server does not log HTTP headers by default. So unless you want to capture a TCP packet trace over non-SSL, I recommend you log them in the web server. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed now to slide number 14. Okay, so here are a couple of quick examples showing them in context along with the expected access log output. Notice the difference with and without using a prefixed text string. I personally recommend using a prefixed text string whenever possible. It makes reading the data in the access logs a lot easier and simpler to identify. Next slide, please, slide number 15. Okay, logging essential number 2, which is cookies. There are 3 ways to log cookies in the access log, depending on which type of cookie information you want to log. To log a specific inbound incoming cookie, you want to use percent, bracket, the name of the cookie, bracket, and then the letter C, and that's a capital C. If you desire instead to log all the inbound cookies, this can be done by simply logging the inbound cookie request header. And finally, to log out all outbound cookies, you must log the contents of the set cookie response header. Okay. Note, you can prefix using a text string if desired, and I show that here. So let's proceed down to slide number 16 to see some quick examples. Okay, so here we have an example of a cookie request header which contains 3 cookies, a JSession ID cookie, an LM token cookie, and an LM cookie. Now, no cookies are separated by semicolons, and that's how you can differentiate them. As indicated in the previous section, you can log the entire cookie header or just one of the cookies. Okay, so let's proceed now to slide number 17. Okay, so here is one example in context. We're logging just, in this case, we're logging the entire cookie header. So we're logging all 3 cookies, and this is what it would look like in your access log. Okay, slide number 18, please. Okay, and here is another example in context showing the logging of just the JSession ID cookie. The previous slide, we logged the entire cookie header, and in this slide, we just want to log the one cookie, the JSession ID cookie. Okay, slide 19, please. Okay, moving right along, example of a set cookie response header, which can be logged using percent, bracket, set cookie, bracket, and the letter O. Next slide, please, slide number 20. Okay, I'm sure by now you're getting the idea, but finally here's an example of context of logging a set cookie response header which contains a JSession ID. Again, by default, the web server does not log cookies, so you should know how to log them in all cases for the purpose of advanced debugging. This really comes in handy when debugging like single sign-on issues as well as session affinity issues. Okay, with that said, let's proceed to slide number 21 to discuss logging essential number 3, environment variables. Okay, the web server provides a mechanism for storing information in named variables that are called environment variables. This information can be used to control various operations such as logging. To log the value of an environment variable requires specifying the name of the environment variable and the letter E. Now, here are two very important and useful environment variables used by IBM support. These are two you won't want to forget. I can't stress that enough. Kind of like the keys in your car. You can walk or ride a bike instead, but certainly faster to get to your destination in a car, but this requires the keys. It is certainly faster to determine which module handled the request or what app server handled the request by logging it, but this requires the RH and WAS environment variables. Okay, note that mod status with extended status on is required to use these two environment variables, so please keep that in mind. Okay, so let's proceed now to slide number 22. Okay, next are the SSL environment variables, which can also be logged. These can be broken down into three areas. We have the SSL handshake environment variables, we have the client certificate environment variables, as well as the server certificate environment variables, okay? It is extremely useful to become familiar with the SSL environment variables, especially if you are debugging SSL handshake failures, client or server certificate validation problems. Okay, to be able to log this information is extremely important and helpful. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 23. Okay, so here we have a list of environment variables that pertain to the SSL handshake. You can log any one of these by simply entering the name of the variable. For example, to determine if a request was handled over an SSL connection, you can log this using the HTTPS environment variable. Don't forget to add the letter E as shown. Okay? So next slide, number 24. Okay, there are many client certificate environment variables, just to make you aware. I couldn't include them all in the presentation, but here is a partial list for your awareness. Okay, the two most common that we log is the client CN and client DN, which is the distinguished name and the common name of the certificate. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed now to slide number 25. I lost my screen there for a minute. Okay, finally, here are the environment variables pertaining to the server certificate. Note this is a complete list. As indicated earlier, any SSL environment variable can be logged in the access log. This includes those pertaining to the SSL handshake, the client and server certificate. So you can log any one of these in the access log. Okay, so let's move on to slide number 26 to continue with the topic of environment variables. Okay, so there are two directives that pertain to environment variables which can be used in conjunction with the log format and custom log directives. They are set env if and set env. I will start by focusing first on set env if. Please take a moment to read the slide. Okay, so in addition to logging using set env if, set env if can also be used to prevent requests from being logged as well. This is an ideal way to limit your access logs from filling up too quickly. Next slide, please, slide number 27. Okay, in my opinion, here are two great examples. The first one shows how to use set env if in conjunction with the custom log to prevent the logging of image requests to the access log. Notice the environment variable is image-request, and notice the env equal exclamation at the end of the custom log line. An exclamation mark means not. So basically, this means log everything to the log, but not the .gif and not the .jpg request. Okay? The second example shows how to prevent head requests from being logged. Now, load balancers typically use the head method to send health check requests to the server every couple of seconds. It's pretty common. We see that a lot. These can fill up your logs pretty quickly. So if you want to actually prevent your access log from being filled up, I recommend you use this environment and set env if environment variable here. Okay? So definitely don't want a log head request if you can avoid it, and here's the way you do that. Okay? So next slide, slide number 28. Okay, so here is a final example of set env if. This example basically says, if the accept language request header contains en for English, set an environment variable called English. The custom log directives are then set up to log the English request to one log and the non-English request to another log. So here's a prime example of how you can use set env if to break up requests and log them to different logs. Okay, so let's move on now to slide number 29. Okay, so set env directive is another way to set environment variables. However, these variables are set internally and then made available to other request handlers such as CGI, server-side includes, etc. Now, as far as logging, let's review the example on the next slide, slide number 30. Okay, so for those that use mod cache, here is a great way to log whether the content was served from cache or not. Since mod env is skipped when the file is served from cache, the environment variable does not get set. So you can see here that the slash JTS request was served from cache, while the slash CCM requests were not. This is a great environment variable to use when trying to determine what content is being cached and what content is not. This concludes the discussion on environment variables. So now let's proceed to slide number 31 to talk about debug modules. Okay, so the IHS Diag package is a fantastic diagnostic package. This package was created by development specifically for the purpose of aiding in debugging of the web server. There are four diagnostic modules provided in the package. All of these modules produce logging output that is essential for advanced debugging, depending on the problem. I will discuss each of these individually in the upcoming slides, but they are mod underscore net underscore trace, mod underscore what killed us, mod underscore backtrace, and mod underscore npm stats. For version 6.1, you will need to obtain the modules by downloading the package. And then for version 7.0 and above, the modules are already located in the modules debug directory, so you can check that out at your own leisure. Okay, so let's proceed now to slide number 32. Okay, mod underscore net underscore trace can be enabled to trace network activity between the web server and the web browser or any other client. Okay, it actually records the actual data sent and received from the server and the client. So you're actually logging the data that's coming in on the network and being sent out by the server. This is a wonderful alternative to enabling TCP packet traces in some cases, especially if the data is over SSL, okay, because modnettrace will actually decrypt the data. So the log that you're producing is going to actually show you that data. So with that said, you probably only want to enable it in the case of debugging and not leave it enabled all the time. Okay, plus it would fill up your logs. Okay, so when enabling it, you can use an asterisk to log traffic from all clients, or you can list a client IP address if interested in logging data for just a specific client. So for a complete set of instructions, please visit the link shown. Okay, next slide, please, slide number 33. Okay, here is a quick example of what the nettrace.log output looks like. I know this is a lot of data to look at, but the key things to take away from this log are the following. The time of the request, which is shown on the far left. The IP address of the client, which in this case is just a local client. I did use a local client, so that's why you're seeing the 127 address. Okay, and then on the far right, you see the request headers and the response data. The log also shows the number of bytes received and sent between the client and the server. So again, a great debug tool to use, especially over SSL, and it's a great alternative to having to enable TCP packet traces. I'm not saying that TCP packet traces are never needed. They certainly are, but this is an alternative to get a quick idea of what's going on, okay? So let's go ahead and proceed now to slide number 34. Okay, so the next debug module is mod underscore what killed us. When a child process crashes in IHS, this module attempts to write information to the error log, a very useful debug module since it will log the actual request which was handled on the child thread which crashed. In addition, it will log the current TCP connection. In version 7.0 and higher, it will even log the module that was active. Note that mod status with extended status on must also be enabled to log the active module. Okay, so for a complete set of instructions, again, I recommend that you please visit the link shown here. All right, so let's go ahead now and proceed to slide number 35. Okay, here you can see a clear example of the benefit of this module. By default, when a child process crashes, you normally just see a segmentation fault or some other non-descriptive message log. But with mod what killed us enabled, you get much more. Okay, here you can clearly see the PID number of the child process which crashed, the connection that was active, which shows the client IP and the port, along with the server IP and port. In addition, you can see the client request headers, including the URI of the request, which was active. And finally, since this is version 7.0, you can see the active module, which in this case was the plugin module. Okay? So moving on now to slide number 36. Okay, on Linux and ZOS operating systems, it is not always possible for a child process to produce a core file during a crash. As a result, development came up with the debug module, with a debug module, to help capture backtrace information and write it to the error log, thus the name mod underscore backtrace. For a complete set of instructions, please visit the link here. Okay, so slide number 37. Okay, so here is an example of what the mod backtrace output might look like. Again, notice that the PID number of the child process is recorded. Also, the module which was active at the time of the crash is recorded, along with the complete backtrace. Okay, again, this writes to the error log. Okay, as you can see, the child process crashed while the plugin module was attempting to process the certificate provided by the application server. Okay, moving on now to slide number 38. Okay, finally we have mod underscore npm stats. This module is a must-have for debugging performance issues and possible thread utilization problems. Just like the other modules, the information this module outputs is written to the error log. Basically, this module provides a snapshot of all active threads running in the IBM HTTP server, and it records this information to the error log depending on the report interval specified. So here you can see it is set to 600 seconds, which is 10 minutes. So every 10 minutes, the module writes the state of all the active threads to the log. Okay, so next slide, slide number 39. Okay, so here is an example of mod underscore npm stats. So what this example shows is that 05.16.07 npm stats shows the server is about to reach max clients, which is currently set to 600. It shows that 541 threads are busy, while 35 are ready to handle new work. So out of the 541 which are busy, it also is telling us that 417 of those are in a write state, while 122 of those are in a keep alive state, and two are in a closed connection state. We can also see that the bulk of the write state threads are in the plugin module. Most likely, these are threads waiting on a response from the backend WAS server. That's a little tip that I'll give you. If you see that most busy threads are in the plugin module, it typically means that the plugin has a connection open to the WAS server and is waiting for the WAS server to return a response. Okay? That creates what we like to call a backward domino effect. And eventually your web server can run out of threads, hit max clients, because all the threads are tied up in plugin waiting for the back end. So the root problem here really is that the back end WAS server is having problems and it's affecting the front end web server. Mod npm stats, a great way to debug and to see that that's happening. Okay. All right, so let's go ahead now and move on to slide number 40. Okay. Now, I know firsthand that debugging can be challenging. I also know that debugging effectively without essential logging is almost impossible. I covered a lot of material today already, and I hope you did find it useful. The purpose of this final part of the presentation is to help put things in perspective, basically to put it all together, okay, to leave you with a better contextual understanding of essential logging for advanced debugging. Okay, so let's go ahead and move forward, starting with slide number 41. Okay, so how to know if the request was handled as an encrypted SSL request or as an unencrypted non-SSL request? Very simple. You can actually use the HTTPS environment variable. I show the example here. And if the request was handled over SSL, the value will actually be reported as on. You can prefix it with a text string. In this case, I chose the text string of SSL. Okay? If the request was handled over non-SSL, meaning it was not encrypted, it would actually say off instead of on. Okay? So how to log the IP address of the client when a front-end device is being used and mask the real client IP? So a lot of times you'll have load balancers in front of your web server sending requests. You look in the access log, and the only IP address that you're seeing is the web server, is the load balancer client address. You don't actually see the real client address. So it does take a little bit of coordination with your admins, your load balancer admins, but if you can talk to your load balancer admins and ask them to enable the exported 4 header and insert the real client IP address, when that header is provided with the request, you can log it in the access log, okay, by using the exported 4 I, and I, again, is for inbound header, so you're logging the exported 4 inbound client header. As a result, not only do you see the load balancer IP, which is the .05 IP, but you also see the real client IP that initiated this request, in this case, the .211 IP address. Okay, very important, especially if you're debugging client issues. You see failed requests, or you see possibly a hacker is sending requests to the server. You want to identify who the real client is, but all you're able to know by default is the load balancer IP. Well, sure enough, if you can work with your load balancer admins, have them forward the client IP in the exported 4 header, you can log it and more clearly identify where those requests are coming from. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed now to slide number 42. Okay, so if you want to log the client certificate, if you're using SSL client auth required or using SSL client auth auth required directive, that does require that the client pass a certificate during the handshake, and a lot of times you can limit access based on a specific value of a certificate, and what you can do is you can actually log that information in the access log to get a feel for who's actually accessing your site. And in this case, you can do that using any one of the client environment variables. In this case, the most common one we use is the SSL underscore client underscore DN environment variable, which will allow you to log the distinguished name of the actual client certificate that was presented to the server. Okay? Okay. Next, how to confirm what cipher suite was used for every request. This, again, is very useful. A lot of times, PMRs will come into support saying that our scanner, our vulnerability scanner, is saying that IHS is supporting ciphers, that it should not be. And a lot of times, that may not necessarily be true, although it could be. But one way to confirm once and for all is to actually log the ciphers. Why don't go ahead and log those ciphers in the access log? It'll tell you for every single request that IHS handled and processed, you can see what actual cipher was used. And a lot of times what we'll do is if we have a little bit of a conflict between what the scanner says is happening and what IHS is actually doing, we a lot of times will ask you, customers, to enable this value so that you can log and see for yourself what cipher is being used, and you can then provide that access log to your security team. And whether they accept it or not is one thing, but it certainly is evidence to prove to your security team that IHS is, in fact, using the ciphers that we say it is using. Okay? So let's go ahead now and proceed to slide number 44. Okay, a session affinity issues in the web server plugin. We see a lot of PMRs on this topic. I'm sure you have probably experienced this from time to time. There is information that you can log to make the debugging process much easier. I personally think that this is absolutely essential for advanced debugging because by default, JSession ID information is not logged, as well as the WAS server. Unless you want to go through the painstake of enabling a plugin trace, you really don't know what WAS server the requests are being sent to. So this really is a good way to log that information. Here you can see I've indicated that I actually want to log the JSession ID cookie. In addition, I want to use the WAS environment variable so that I know what WAS server this request was sent to. And in addition, I want to log the set cookie output header. And the reason for that is because if in a case where you have a request come in with a JSession ID cookie, the plugin picks a server and sends it to that server. If session affinity is not broken, then there's no reason to have a new set cookie. However, in typical cases where you see session affinity breaking, it's usually in a case where a client comes in and passes a JSession ID cookie that contains a clone ID on the end, and it's sent to a server, in this case WAS2, and you see that a new JSession ID cookie is set, and notice here that the clone ID is changed. That is a clear indication that session affinity has broken. Now, does this tell you why session affinity was broken? No. Typically, you would have to go move forward and capture a plugin trace to further isolate, since session affinity is a function of the plugin. So if it is breaking, you would most likely need to enable plugin tracing. However, before you go down that route, you can certainly quickly identify where you're seeing session affinity breaks, what clients are being impacted, etc. Okay? Let's go ahead now and proceed to slide number 44. Okay, so slow response times. Again, we see a lot of issues on slow response times. Typically, we will come back and ask you to log this information, so I'm sharing it with you today so that you can know ahead of time to log it and possibly understand it. So what this example shows is that I'm logging what WAS server the requests are being sent to. In addition, I'm logging how long each request is taking in microseconds. And here you can see I kind of differentiated between the red and the blue. The red is showing me clearly when I'm looking at my log that the WAS4 server seems to be taking a lot longer time than the WAS2 server. The WAS2 server, I can see here all my requests completed under a second. And for the WAS4 server, I can see that at least one request took 80-plus seconds, while the other two requests took 24-plus seconds. Again, it's a good way to know from a web server perspective, okay, I'm having some issues here. I'm getting slow response times. I want to log those response times and help further isolate where the actual delays might be coming from. In this case, I can clearly see that WAS4 server is having a problem, and it allows me to go forward and maybe start debugging that environment. Maybe collect thread dumps, et cetera. Those are things that you can do to debug slow performance issues within WebSphere. This is just a great way to log the information in the IHS access log to help you with that debugging effort. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed now to slide number 45. Okay, so debugging the source of error status codes. Great little trick. If you have requests that are failing with 404 errors or 500 errors, et cetera, you can actually use the RH environment variable, and it'll actually generate the request handler that was used. In this particular case, you can see that the /foo.html, the core.c handler was used. So what does that tell us? That tells us if you ever see core.c as the handler for a 404 response, it actually does mean that the 404 was generated by the IHS server, most likely because it's serving that content from the local directory, document root in this case. If you do see a 404 logged in the access log and it shows you that the plugin module is the handler, that typically means that the 404 actually came from the WAS application server. Because again, who's handling the request? From an IHS perspective, it's the plugin. But the plugin doesn't generate a 404 status code. Instead, the plugin would receive a 404 status code from the application server. So again, it's a great way to determine by using RH which environment is actually generating the 404. Is it the IHS server, or is it actually the WAS server? Okay? And then also for 500 requests, again, you can see 500 requests being generated from time to time. The question is, who generated them, right? In this case, we see two examples. You see a 500 with the plugin module listed. Now, granted, this is a little gray area, but when you do see a 500 generated and it shows the plugin module as the handler, at least it isolates it that it's not another module within IHS. Instead, it would indicate that either the plugin itself generated the 500, maybe it failed to connect to the backend server, or maybe it sent the request to the backend server and the backend server returned a 500. Either way, you know more now than you did without logging this information, so it's good to do. Finally, we have another case where you get a 500. In this case, it's on just get slash, and you can clearly see here that the module listed is mod underscore SM. So this would clearly tell us that the 500 was generated by the third-party SiteMinder module. Again, it's a great way for advanced debugging to figure out and narrow down the scope of the problem so you can further isolate what's causing or what component to focus on. Okay, so let's go ahead now and proceed to slide number 47. Okay, this is a pretty busy slide. I actually even have trouble reading it from time to time, but I'll do my best here. %A basically means the local server IP address. It's one of the log formats that's provided in the chart that I referenced in the beginning of the presentation, where all the log formats are listed. %A is one. We didn't cover it earlier, but I did want to mention what it means now since I have it highlighted here. %V is the canonical server name. Again, that's one of the format strings in that chart in the beginning of the presentation. Okay. All right, so that would be the canonical server name. And then what I'm doing here is I'm using setenv directive. And what am I doing? I'm setting an environment variable called the host name. And then I'm also giving a value to that environment variable. In the global scope of IHS, I'm giving it a value of main. Inside my virtual host, I'm also setting the same environment variable, but I'm giving it a different unique name. In one case, I'm calling it vhost 8443, and in the other virtual host, I'm calling it vhost 443. Now, why is this so important? Well, a lot of times we have requests coming into the server, and you're not really sure what virtual host actually handled those requests. Especially when you're dealing with SSL handshake problems, you may have multiple SSL virtual hosts defined, and you're not sure which one actually handled the request. By default, you won't know. By simply looking at your access log. But by this little trick here, by using setenv, you can actually start to see what virtual host actually did handle the request. So in the example, you can see getfile.html. I can see that the local server IP address is the .89 address. So immediately I know, okay, I know which virtual host that IP address belongs to. In addition, I'm logging the canonical server name, so I do know in my virtual host, again, that server name directive is used. And then finally, I'm logging the environment variable that I set for that particular virtual host. In this case, it's vhost 8443. So as a result, I clearly know by looking at the access log that getfile.html was served by my 8443 virtual host. Okay? Great little trick. Highly recommend it, especially in the case where you're trying to 100% confirm what virtual host is handling all your requests. You can configure it this way, and it'll certainly tell you. Okay, so let's go ahead now and proceed to slide number 47. Okay, so this is the last log. Oh, yes, this is the last slide, I should say, for situational logging. So how to see what cache control headers are being set on server responses. This is really important if you're having caching issues on the client side, or you're maybe using mod headers to set cache control headers, or even if your application server is setting cache control headers, or you're not sure if your application server is setting cache control headers. Well, why don't you log them? It's real simple to do. Here is a prime example. I've listed basically all of them, the Pragma, expires, cache control, etag, et cetera. You can log them. And you can see two examples here. The first example shows for servlet slash snoop. You can notice that all my values are empty. There's a hyphen there. So they're all empty, meaning that for at least that particular request, there were no cache control headers set. However, for the index.html request, you can clearly see there are values. And the values are indicating that these are the cache control headers that were set on the response, and therefore these are the headers that are being sent back to the client browser. Okay? So again, if you're debugging cache control issues, especially on the browser side, it's good to know what actual cache control headers are being set, whether they're being set. And so this is a great way to do that. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed now to slide number 48, and we'll just kind of wrap up here. To kind of give you a quick summary of what we just covered. I know I went really quick. There was a lot of information. It's already 11:51, so we've used up the time pretty quickly. I did provide you a logs overview, very simple, but we discussed the error access and rewrite logging, talked about the default settings, error log, log format, custom log directives, and in addition, I gave you a brief intro to mod underscore rewrite logging. Obviously, mod rewrite is a pretty complex module. Personally, I think the way it processes traffic is pretty straightforward, especially I hope you saw that when we looked at the rewrite log, that it's really not that complicated. But there are a lot of things involved, regular expressions and stuff like that that can be used. So if you are using rewrite rules, I highly recommend the logging, but unfortunately we couldn't get into a ton of detail simply because we could probably have a whole class on that one topic. In addition, I covered what I consider the four logging essentials. I provided you logging examples. We talked about how to log inbound and outbound HTTP headers. Again, you can log any inbound and any outbound header. There is no header you cannot log, which is great to know. Highly recommend you do it. It comes in handy. Logging cookies. We talked about how to log the entire cookie header. We talked about how to log just a specific cookie. And we talked about how to log the set cookie response header. In particular, I covered environment variables. We talked about two important ones, the WAS environment variable, as well as the RH for request handler environment variable. I also did discuss the SSL environment variables along with the two directives, which are used to actually set those, to set environment variables, set env if and set env, gave you examples on how you can utilize them in your environment, whether to log something or not to log something. In addition, we talked about debug modules, very useful, highly recommend you use them. Mod underscore net underscore trace captures network activity between the client and server. Mod npm stats gives you the health of the server, thread utilization, things like that, great for performance debugging. Mod backtrace and mod what killed us, great for crashes. If you're experiencing a crash, highly recommend these modules. It can give you a ton of information produced to the error log that you normally wouldn't see. Okay, and then finally we discussed situational logging. Talked about how to log things, SSL requests, session affinity, we covered that, slow response times, cache headers, how to log the client IP address, especially in cases where you have a front-end load balancer that's masking the client IP. In addition, we talked about how to identify what virtual host actually handled your request through logging. And in addition, we talked about error status codes, how to identify which module actually generated the status code. Okay, all good information. Obviously, it's essential, and I at least think so. I hope you do as well. This is essential logging for advanced debugging. Debugging without this information, it can be done, but it's difficult. So if you have this information handy, I highly recommend you keep a copy of this presentation. You can refer to it at any time, and it can help you along the way with your debugging efforts. Okay, so let's go ahead now and proceed to slide number 49. Okay, so this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts, like the one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations, like the plugin one that I told you about in the beginning of the presentation. DeveloperWorks offers an in-depth technical information. You can also visit WebSphereUserGroup.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for the Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. Okay, so that concludes today's presentation. I'd like to, at this time, turn it back over to David Long.
Thank you, Rob, for a great presentation. At this time, we would like to open the lines for questions.
At this time, there are no phone questions.
Thank you. We do have a couple questions in the group chat. The first one is, if you're serving static pages from in directories, can the logging be set to create in separate sets of log files?
Okay, that is a great question. And before I answer that question, I also was looking at some of the chat comments. And in the very beginning, there was a comment about someone asking if I could slow down a little bit. And I do apologize for going through the presentation quickly, but as you can tell, it was a lot of information. And I struggled with this a bit when I was putting it together. I was trying to decide whether or not to limit the information I shared with you so that I could spend more time with it, or ensuring that you had all of the vital information that we use in support. And I thought it better to provide you all the information, considering that these webcasts are replayed and posted. So I highly recommend that if you did think I went a little too fast, that you listen to the replay and listen to it as many times as you like. And I think it'll really sink in, and I think in the long run you'll be thankful that I provided you more information than less information. Okay? So with that said, to answer your question, yes, you can write two separate logs. There's two things. One is you can define as many custom log directives as you like. You can define a separate one for each virtual host, per se. Let's say you have five virtual hosts and you want all requests handled by one virtual host to be logged in a specific access log, while you want requests handled by another virtual host to be logged in a different access log. The way to do that, you would simply use a separate custom log directive in each virtual host. That's a simple thing to do. In addition to that, as I showed earlier, you can use setenvif to set an environment variable. So, for example, let's say you want to log all image requests to one log, and you want to log everything else to a different log. Similar to how I showed you the English-speaking browser example, you can do something very similar to separate out requests that way. I'm not sure if that answers your question. If not, please clarify it, and we can discuss it further.
Thank you, Rob. And then the next question. Which module gives you the RH support?
Okay, you do have to have mod status enabled with the extended status on option. So if you do have that module enabled, then you can use the WASE environment variable as well as the RH environment variable.
Thank you. And then another question. Do you need to recycle a HTTP server after you make changes to log format for the changes to be active?
Yes, anytime, and it's not just making logging changes. Anytime you make any change to the httpd.com file, whether you're setting log level to debug, whether you're adding values to your log format string, if you're adding strings to that, or you're defining additional custom log directives, or making any other change in the httpd.com file, such as listen ports, directory stanzas, etc., no matter what changes you make, yes, you do need to save that and restart the web server. You can do it one of two ways. You can either do a clean stop using Apache CTL space stop and then Apache CTL space start, or you can do a graceful restart, which would be a Apache CTL graceful. You can also do an Apache CTL space restart. But the bottom line is whenever you do make a change to the httpd.com, you want to save that change and restart the server.
Thank you. And then another question, how do we set multiple doc root in IHS? Basically, I want to have /log/WAS location as doc root. This question was sent directly to me, so you won't see it.
Okay. Well, you can only have one document root per scope, meaning that your global scope can have a document root. If you have a virtual host, you can use a separate document root for that, but you can only have one document root per scope. So, for example, if you have five virtual hosts and your main scope, you can have a document root in your main scope, and then you can have a separate document root inside each one of your virtual hosts. So, in reality, you may have six document roots overall. Okay. In addition to that, if you want to, in addition to your document root, you can use the alias directive. The alias directive defines URIs. So you can say that, okay, if I come in and request /my content, I want to actually serve that out of a different directory. I don't want to serve that out of the document root. You certainly can do that by using the alias directive. Okay? That's a way to bypass that limitation of only having one document route defined per scope. Now, with that said, I do want to emphasize here, just so that when you're trying to do this, you don't, if you run into a problem, you don't come back and say, hey, this doesn't work. If you are trying to use the alias directive, if you're using it to define a URI that also exists in your plugin, that alias directive will be ignored, just so you know that. Plugin does take precedence over alias, mod alias. So let's, for example, let's say you're trying to say any request that comes in with slash servlet, I want to serve that content out of this WAS directory, and I want it to be served by IHS. I don't actually want it to be sent to WAS. Well, unfortunately, that simply won't work if you have slash servlet URI also defined in the plugin. Plugin takes precedence, and therefore plugin is going to send that request to WAS. There really is no way around that other than a few tricks. Unfortunately, I can't really talk about those tricks here, just not enough time to do that. I did provide my email address. If you want to send me an email, I certainly can discuss it further with you.
All right, thank you. And then the next question, is there a single string to capture all SSL logging?
Unfortunately, no. The closest you can get to capturing all SSL-related information is a JISCIT trace, but those are encrypted and only viewable by Level 3 development. So the real answer to that is no. You would have to create a very long log format and list all of those environment variables. I have seen it done. Sometimes we get in cases where it's such a complex issue that we want to log a lot of those environment variables. Maybe we want to log a lot of the client certificate environment variables as well as the server certificate environment variables. So what we end up doing is providing you, the customer, with this really long log format example that has all of them defined. Unfortunately, that is the only way to do it. Looks ugly, but you can do it. It's just ugly. So there's no flag, if you will, that you just turn on and it's all done for you.
All right, thank you. And then another question, how do I best trace a 400 bad request error?
Okay, well, a 400 bad request error can be, it's typically a client-side issue, so the best way to generate that is using mod underscore net underscore trace, because typically a 400 bad request, in most cases, not all cases, but most cases, a 400 bad request will occur for two reasons. One is either all of the data that's defined within the content length header is not present, especially in post requests. You may see that from time to time. You'll issue a post request, and in that post request, the content length header says that I'm going to be sending 800 bytes of data. But the actual body data that the client submits is far less than that. As a result, a 400 would be generated because it is technically a bad client request. Well, you can log that data within using mod underscore net underscore trace to actually see what was submitted by the client. In addition to that, you can log the content length incoming header or inbound header using the content dash length I for inbound. Add that to your log format, and sure enough, you'll be able to actually see what number of bytes the client broadcasted. And then by looking at the mod net trace, you can identify how much data was actually sent. So that's one reason a 400 would be generated. Another common cause for 400 bad request issues is that something in the one of the headers is invalid. Possibly the URL length, the URI is so long that it exceeds the default setting, which I believe is 8,197 bytes. IHS does limit the length of the URI, and if the length of the URI exceeds that, then IHS would generate a 400 bad response. If any of the header values, let's say the cookie header, another great example, cookie headers can be very, very long because they contain a lot of cookies, LM token cookies, LTPA token cookies, SSO-related cookies can be extremely long. And sometimes the cookie header gets so abundantly filled that it exceeds the web server default setting, and as a result, the web server will say, hey, client error, this is a bad request, and generate a 400. So those are some of the other reasons why a 400 would be generated. And if you want to log that, just simply log those headers. You can log any header you'd like in IHS using header I for inbound, as well as outbound. But in this case, for 400 bad request errors, it is a client-related error per se, and therefore it would most likely be related to an inbound header being too long or invalid or improperly formatted. So I highly recommend that you log the inbound headers. In addition to that, I recommend you get a mod underscore net underscore trace. Sorry for that long-winded answer, but I do think it needed that explanation.
All right, thank you. And then another question, what about percent %T, percent %D? I was told that it would show the amount it took to process a request, which was confirmed by Rob during today's presentation, but it would show total time it took in seconds, milliseconds. For example, 5/567 would mean it took 5 seconds, 567 milliseconds. Is that correct?
Partially. Percent %T does record total processing time in seconds, meaning from the time that the web server reads in the client request to the time it finishes writing the response to the client. So anything that's happening in between there is eating up the time. So, for example, if you send a request to IHS, let's say it's a simple GET request, right? So IHS reads in that request very quickly and passes it to plugin. Plugin parses it, says, okay, I need to send that to WAS server 1. And it sends it to WAS server 1. And then now it's waiting for WAS server 1 to provide a response. That entire time the plugin is sitting there waiting, that timer is ticking. And then WAS finally sends the response, and plugin hands it off to the web server, and the web server now is writing that response to the client. Taking a while. Maybe there's network latency going on, so it's taking a while for the server to actually finish, or the web server to finish writing the response. Finally, that response is written. Now you have an idle connection. During that entire time, that timer was ticking. So you can see it's total processing time. Percent %T is in seconds. Percent %D is the part where you're a little bit in error there. Percent %D is not milliseconds. It is microseconds. Big difference. So just keep that in mind. Percent %D is microseconds. And to be honest, when you're debugging, I personally recommend percent %D. I think it's a little bit more accurate than seconds, because seconds is obviously a hard value, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, microseconds kind of gives you a lot more of the in between those seconds, and you can always convert it to seconds later. So percent %D is really better, in my opinion. And in addition to that, I just want to put this out there. I do recommend that if you're going to do if you're going to log percent %T and percent %D or one or the other, that you use the time prefix string. We talked about prefix strings in the presentation. It's just a text string. It can be any text string you want. It doesn't have to say time colon, but we typically like to recommend it by using time colon as the text prefix. And it's just an easier way to identify those in the access log. Otherwise, it just looks like this long number in the access log. And if you got if you're logging a lot of data in the access log, it's, okay, is that where I'm logging time? I can't remember. So by actually using a prefix text string of time colon, it does make it easier to find.
All right, thank you. And then the next question, is there a web link to list all IHS environment variables?
Good question, and I'll be honest, I've yet to find that. I mean, the ones that are really important, to be quite honest with you, are the SSL environment variables, and those are all logged. If you send me an email, I'll be happy to give you the links. If you can't find those, they are in the info center. As far as other environment variables, I mean, a lot of environment variables are simply set. They're arbitrary, meaning, and what I mean by that is you make them up, I mean, in some cases, and you give them the value that you want, especially when using set END. Not in all cases, but in some cases, you know, they're made up values, or they're made up variable names that you're giving a value to. But not in all cases, so I just want to be clear. But no, is there a list? I'm yet to find one. If someone finds one, I'd love for you to send it to me, because I've been at this a long time, and I still can't really find one. Other than the SSL environment variables, those are listed.
All right, thank you. And then there's another question. When IHS receives an HTTP request, does it first look at the plugin file or look at Veho's configuration to handle the request?
Okay, good question. The very first thing is the vHost is looked at first. The reason for that is, especially over SSL, SSL is an IP-based protocol, which means that that when the client initiates an SSL handshake to the web server, it's actually initiating that handshake with an IP address, right? It's making a TCP connection to an IP address. And then it performs an SSL handshake, and it's not till the handshake completes and you have an encrypted connection that the request is actually sent across that connection. So once the request comes into the web server says, okay, now I have a host header I can evaluate, and I look at that and I say, okay, well, which virtual host handles that? Well, if it's over SSL, it can only handle it based on the IP address that the connection was attempted to. Unless you're using SAN certificates, and that's kind of a whole nother discussion, there's a little bit of a trick there. Again, email me. I'd be happy to talk about that. But the short answer to your question is the virtual hosts are looked at first. Once the virtual host receives the request, then it's passed to the plugin for further processing.
All right. Thank you. So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Rob, for presenting today.
Sure, you're welcome.